Greetings, everyone, to another episode of the podcast. Now, you'll notice I'm doing something a little bit different this week, and that's because I do want to let all my listeners know that my guest this week, Jonathan Steele, tells a story that might be triggering for some of you. Now, as we know, the war between Israel and Hamas began last year, and it has been nothing short of tragic on all sides. It is triggering for many. The subject is a difficult one, and on a scale for humanity, it's devastating. So we do discuss that event this episode, and I wanted to let you know that if this subject distresses you in any way, you might want to skip this episode. So with that, let's get back to our regularly scheduled programming. Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This week, I interview Jonathan Steele, and among many other things, Jonathan is a lawyer. But outside the courtroom, Jonathan is dedicated to community service, providing pro bono legal aid through JUF Community Legal Services and contributing to medical research initiatives as a board member of the Medical Research Junior Board Foundation at Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. He's transitioned from law to cybersecurity and has spent years researching all aspects of cybersecurity and privacy. Now, we had a very open and interesting conversation this week, and as I indicated in the intro, it might be a little difficult for some of you, but Jonathan has such a warm spirit and welcoming soul. I think that his powerful story, that of a father trying to save his family, will resonate with many of you. All right, let's get into this very next episode of the podcast and my interview with Jonathan Steele.
And so that, you know, I'm there with my wife, with my two kids. And so you go into sort of like fight or flight mode, right? And you try to make sure that your family is safe. And we drove from the south to the north with smoldering piles of rocket debris on each side of the road. My five-year-old's watching Bluey on an iPad. My two-year-old is crying in and out of sleep. And, you know, they're asking me, is the smoke on the side of the road, is that candles? And, you know, they're blissfully ignorant to what's going on, that there's literally a war going on. I'm a few things. I'm a lawyer. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I'm a son. I'm a brother. So, you know, depending on what kind of conference I'm in, I might pick one of those over the other. Most likely you're going to hear me say I'm a lawyer.
And how did that happen? When you were a kid, did you think this is what I want to do? Or how did that kind of come about?
Yeah, my grandfather was a lawyer. That certainly teased law for me. I was misled as a kid into thinking, go into law and you'll be rich and famous. That hasn't happened yet. Maybe that's coming. And then, you know, I just started clerking for a lawyer when I was in high school and just sort of latched on since then. So it sort of fell into it.
And so who is selling you this myth of like the rich and famous thing?
Everyone everywhere. You know, they tell you as a kid, you just be a doctor, be a lawyer, and all of the fancy cars and homes are going to come with that. And maybe that's coming and I just haven't seen it yet. But so far, I'm waiting for it.
And what kind of law do you practice?
I do divorce law. So it's everything under the umbrella of family, but it's primarily divorce. So ugly stuff. But, you know, we're trying to help people through tough times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, I think you have to have a really, I don't know, stout heart to kind of even enter those arenas where two people are dissolving their marriage. And probably it's not amicably. It's probably most of the time not a happy place for either of them. And to just show up, I think, takes incredible fortitude and bravery. I don't know if you feel that way, but I know I couldn't do it.
It's tough. It's heavy sometimes. Certainly what we see is it can be heavy. And people don't usually come to us when it's going to be amicable. We're usually seeing the worst. So you're right.
And so when do you get to choose what kind of law you want to study? Or, you know, when, because I know you can, there's so many different types of law you can practice. When did it happen that you choose divorce?
I don't know that I ever chose divorce, but I the lawyer that I started clerking for was a divorce lawyer. And, you know, I fell into it. I don't particularly love divorce law so much as I love law. And divorce is just a way of practicing law for me. And, you know, I've grown to like it more over time. But there was no point in my life where I said, I think I want to be a divorce lawyer.
And I'm so curious, where did you grow up?
Born and raised in Chicago.
You know what? I grew up in Batavia, Illinois. After I grew up overseas, we came back and I went to school in Batavia, Illinois, and then went to school in college, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, so long ago that we won't even speak about it. But I was just in Batavia last year for several months. And I really, there's something about the city of Chicago that is just amazing. Like, I'm totally into the museums. I mean, talk about world-class museums. And then the food, I love food, because I lived in Santa Fe for about 9 years and they don't do a lot of different foods like Vietnamese and Thai, but Chicago is like this playground. If you're just, you want to go find a certain type of food. And then of course the Cubs, I'm the Cubs all the way.
I thought you were going to say the winters for sure. I was surprised to hear museums. So usually people come here and they love how cold it gets.
Oh gosh. I was telling someone the other day that, maybe I should ask you first, how many months do you actually think summer lasts there?
I might've counted it in days rather than months, but it varies. You know, today it's about 100 degrees. So
okay.
We're enjoying it today, and tomorrow might be a tornado. Tomorrow might be a snowstorm. Who knows?
Yeah, really. I mean, the weather it's not, winters there are pretty bitter. I'll never forget when, after I started my first corporate job after college, and I was near River Forest, I think at that time. And I would leave my apartment. By the time I got to my car, which was parked in this lot across the street, my hair was frozen. It had literally frozen. And then it would slowly defrost as I drove to Skokie to work. But I'd never experienced that in my life before. And I thought, oh my gosh, I just don't even, this is like a whole different world here, closer to the city. You know, it's just, it's a lot colder. And I think that's the lake effect. Are you a Bears fan? Can I ask you? Because it's been pretty grim.
You know, I'm a fair weather fan. I like to go to the games. I like to bring my kids to games, to Cubs games, Bulls games. But I wouldn't consider myself a huge fan. No.
Okay. So you weren't part of the whole Super Bowl shuffle thing with the fridge and the record? Okay. Yeah. We bought the record. We supported them all the way. So my second question always is, you know, did you grow up in a religious household, or what did that look like for you and your family?
You know, I went to a religious day school. So to some extent it was religious. We weren't super religious at home, but I got my fill of that in K through eight school.
And was it because of the excellent education
that school offered? Because I know sometimes parents choose religious like schools slash institutions because the education is kind of excellent.
That was a piece of it, you know, that, but there were equal, if not better, options educationally for where I went to school. So I think the religious part of it was a huge component in that decision making.
When you were growing up in this religious, going to this religious school, did it really resonate with you? Was it something that kind of struck a chord in you? Or did you kind of, I know sometimes kids, you know, they don't really want to go to church, or they don't want to go to synagogue, or they don't want to go to temple, whatever that looks like. And their parents kind of drag them along. When you were going to school, though, at this institution, did any of it resonate with you?
I think it did. You know, what I experienced was where I went to school was also a synagogue. And so I think on weekends, people that went to secular schools would go to Sunday school at the synagogue. And those are the people that seem to grow up and resent the religious component because they were giving up their weekends. And I was in school anyway. And so it was just part of the curriculum. And so it did. It resonated. I don't think I grew up resentful of it the same way they did.
And do you have really fond memories of the neighborhood that you grew up in Chicago?
I do. You know, people, when I went to college, people would ask me, where are you from? And I'd say Chicago. And that, to them, that meant Glencoe, Deerfield, Highland Park. And what I meant was the city. And so when people sort of drilled down past that and they said city, does that mean like you played in the streets? No, I didn't play in the streets. We didn't play soccer, dodging cars. But, you know, there were parks and just like any other neighborhood. And so, yeah, I had fond memories. I still go to the same neighborhood on occasion and I still have those same memories.
I love that they kind of have this notion of this group of kids who are semi-feral playing in the streets.
The thought that that's what that means to grow up in a city is strange.
It is strange. You know, I really loved, I don't know if you read the book, The Devil and the White City, about the Chicago World's Fair down on the waterfront. I think it was like in 1894 or so. Anyway, Tesla provided the lighting for it. And it was the first time in history that, you know, a fair or an exposition had been lit by electrical light. And it was like one of the, I don't know, the eighth wonder of the world. And I've always been kind of excited and proud that Chicago fostered that. Not only Olmsted created the parks that were there, people came from all over the world, but that it was this wonder of the world that everyone came to and just reveled in and was amazed by. And I love that people came to Chicago for that. Chicago's been at this the center of so many amazing historical events. And then, of course, the museums. My favorite, I think, was the science and industry, because as a kid, there was this kind of, well, you felt like you were going down into a coal mine in this thing. I don't know if you went to that when you were a kid, but that was one of my favorite museums, was the Museum of Science and Industry. And then there's like adventures in every street. You don't have to actually be playing in the street to appreciate the city. There's a lot going on there and a lot of great memories and a lot of great restaurants and stories. I came there for one summer in the early 2000s and worked down on the Gold Coast at a restaurant there that's no longer there. It's defunct now. The owner was super connected, and I had to fillet a Dover sole one day, which I couldn't do like in any universe. So the manager was helping me and she said, you have to be really polite to these guys because they're very important. And I, you know, later I said, who was that? And she said, some alderman who'd just gotten out of prison for being corrupt. And I thought, oh my God, this is the perfect example of what Chicago is right there. All these people are just connected and there's some graft, there's some corruption, but it's never boring. That's 100% sure. No way. Well, the main question of my podcast is I would love for you to share a story or stories about something that's happened in your life that, you know, it could be anything, something you thought that was mysterious, something magical or miraculous. I don't know what kind of language you use, something that kind of changed your life. And I'd love to hear more than one. And I've heard everything under the sun. You can imagine, like, ghosts and people being lost in the woods and finding their way out, and fairies and UFOs. I mean, I've heard everything you could ever imagine. Someone who died three times and came back. And that's all to say that any story is welcomed.
Well, I have not died three times, so I don't know that I can top that one. But something that comes to mind, you know, the culminating trip of that religious school that I went to was a trip to Israel. You take 2 weeks and you go to Israel, and it sort of solidifies the language component of what we were learning in school. And I hadn't been back to Israel in quite some time, but I married an Israeli. My wife is Israeli. And her family moved here when she was five. And we go there every year, every other year. And we were in Israel on October 7th last year when the war broke out. And the fact that we survived, the fact that we got out of Israel, to me, it felt like a miracle. We were in the south when the war broke out, and the ground attack was something like 20 kilometers from where we were. And we were one of, if not the last planes out of Israel. We just happened to be leaving anyway that day. We were headed to my cousin's wedding in Paris. And we had our car already booked, which is probably the only reason that we were able to get a car. That was a huge impediment for people to leave. We had our flight already booked, so we weren't scrambling last minute. And, you know, I went to check out that morning and I asked for a final bill, and the front desk was like, have you seen the news? I'm like, no, what are you getting at? Maybe you want to check the news. Maybe you don't want to check out. You know, that alarmed me a little bit. Israel's always got some sort of conflict. There's always rockets. There's always something. But I pressed for a little bit more, and they said, we're at war. And so that, you know, I'm there with my wife, with my two kids. And so you go into sort of like fight or flight mode, right? And you try to make sure that your family is safe. And we drove from the south to the north with smoldering piles of rocket debris on each side of the road. My five-year-old watching Bluey on an iPad. My two-year-old is crying in and out of sleep. And, you know, they're asking me, is the smoke on the side of the road, is that candles? And, you know, they're blissfully ignorant to what's going on, that there's literally a war going on. And to this day, they don't really know what we made it out of. And just the fact that we made it out, to me, is a miracle. It's a blessing. I'm not super confident that if my wife had gone with just our kids, that they would have made it out. And there are just so many bad scenarios and directions that same facts pattern could have taken, that we, I think every step of the way, we got super lucky to have made it out. It's not dying three times, but to me, it felt like a miracle. It felt like quite a relief when the wheels finally took off on the plane. And you know, it's still a little bit surreal looking back on it that we were there for that.
Well, no, I mean, honestly, I don't think anyone ever travels anywhere and imagines anything like what happened that day would ever happen. You know, I know you said that Israel has been at times off and on at war, in conflict. And so it's not, you know, out of the realm of possibility, but just the level at what happened that day. I mean, you don't even plan for that or even consider that it's a possibility. And it sounds like, I mean, first of all, I just want to say, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. And especially with your wife and your kids. But it sounds like everything that had to go right did go right to get you out of there.
That's how it felt. You know, the fact that just having the car service already booked might have been life or death. So it really did feel that way, that everything was just sort of lined up. The flight times, the departure time from the hotel, everything just sort of seemed to be perfectly arranged. It felt like a blessing. It felt like some sort of divine intervention for sure.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, I don't, and it also sounds like, I don't know, do you stay calm under pressure? I mean, I...
Normally, no. You know, what's the expression? Like a swan that's like or a duck or whatever it is, the feet are going crazy under the water and on the surface, they're okay. You know, I had to be okay in the moment. I didn't want the kids to pick up on the fact that I was freaking the hell out. You know, I was trying to stay calm for them, which if anything can make you stay calm, it's your kids. But I was panicking. You know, I was on my phone. I was reading the stories as they were coming in. I'm getting a million different text messages from family. Are you okay? Like, do you need something? I'm trying to make contingency plans. If the car doesn't come, is the roads going to be closed? Are we going to have somewhere else to stay? Do we need to figure out a different hotel? Like, where are we going to go? Like, what's going to happen if X, Y, or Z happens? Because that all falls on me. You know, my wife is sort of deferring to me in that situation. I don't think she really appreciated the gravity of what was happening in the moment. She was more of the mindset, this is our last day here. I don't want to ruin it. I'm going to the pool with the kids. So that was on me. It was on me to make sure that we got out of there safely. And we did. So.
I mean, I appreciate your use of the word surreal. It must have seemed like it wasn't actually real, or that someone was playing a joke on you or something. I mean, that it just couldn't have been real. But then the fact that you understood the severity of what was actually going on and what needed to happen. I mean, kudos to you. I also kind of, I love that your wife was like, I'm going to the pool.
I didn't love that in the moment, but you know, afterwards she did appreciate what was happening. I think once we were in the car and driving past the candles on the side of the road that the kids were seeing, I think she started to appreciate how lucky we were and how serious the situation was, and that I wasn't just overreacting. But in the moment, I think she was thinking, oh, it's no big deal. You know, there's always rockets in Israel. It'll be fine. And I think it's easy to think that way when somebody else is in charge of the safety of family. But when you're the person in charge, the stakes are pretty high, especially with the kids. You know, you can't get up and run if something goes bad, because you've got your 5-year-old, you've got your 2-year-old. And so they're your little anchors that you're dragging around.
Oh, totally. And I do think, you know, it's kind of precious, and thank goodness that you were driving down the road and they're seeing these kind of these scenes of devastation with these rockets and what have you and what they've hit. And they're seeing them as candles, you know, and so I know that when you're very, very young, sometimes you don't remember things, but sometimes you do remember things later in life. And I think it's much better to kind of, when they get older, if they do remember this trip and do remember that it's not with a sense of terror or fear, and that they saw them as candles and they saw them as something not completely awful and horrible. Does that make any sense?
That's my hope. You know, for us as a family, it was a big trip. We were gone for 3 weeks. It was our 10-year wedding anniversary. So the thought that any of us are looking back on it as negative would pain me greatly. I want nothing more than for everyone, the kids, my wife, to look back on it with fond memories. And that was part of what felt like a blessing, is that we didn't lose out on any of our trip. We didn't lose out on anything. We got to enjoy every last minute of it. And we continued on with our trip really without missing a step. And I realize how that sounds. People lost their lives and were kidnapped and still haven't been returned. And to say we didn't miss a beat of our trip sounds awful. But the point is just that it's great that the kids will look back on it with fond memories, and that they're not looking back on it with trauma, which is part of why it was important to try to stay calm for their sake.
also how astonishing to then go to a wedding, right? Right after, I mean, what a pivot. And that must have been surreal as well.
It was a pivot. It was, you know, we were there with my family, who was all like very relieved to see us. They were following obviously closely what was going on, and they were panicking. You know, my sister is a teacher at that school that I came from. And so she goes to Israel yearly with the eighth grade trip, and she was panicking, which panicked everybody that was at the wedding, because she's used to it. And if she's freaking out, there's good reason to freak out. So she was worried. She worried everybody. And so when we finally saw everybody, there was just a huge sigh of relief that we felt around 3 a.m. when the plane finally took off. And so, yeah, it was quite a shift in mood, so to say. I mean, we went from literally a war to a nice 5-star hotel in Paris. That was my first time to Paris. Talk about changing scenery real quick.
Yes, and also to a scene of celebration, right? And joining of two people, getting married, you know, with all the attendant family and friends and visitors from probably everywhere coming in to celebrate. And I can't even imagine making the switch from what you just experienced to then, you know, to that. Was that challenging?
Yes and no. You know, you're going from panic mode to celebration mode, which is tough. But at the same time, you just escaped a war. And so it's easy to feel celebratory. You know, it really felt like we are so lucky. We are so blessed to have made it out. And so what better time is there to feel celebratory, to feel happy? And, you know, it's a magic time in my cousin's life. And so we had to change scenery real quick and celebrate his wedding. And it felt easy enough. You know, it being in a new environment that felt safe was a godsend. And, you know, it felt effortless to change to something happier.
And I was going to say that I do think, you know, events like that, like a wedding, that bring people together to celebrate and have fun and reconnect after maybe years of having, they're like the perfect places to just remember how life is beautiful or why it's beautiful. Does that make any sense?
It does. Even to a divorce lawyer that you would think is sort of jaded by that whole notion. You know, there are people joke that divorce lawyers go to weddings and they hand out business cards that it's inventory. But it's a joke. Divorce lawyers, lawyers in general, we don't think like that. It is still a beautiful institution. It is still love. And, you know, while some marriages don't work out, it doesn't mean they all don't. So it is a celebratory event. And it was, everything about it was great.
Thank you to everyone who listened to this story of Jonathan's. It's a story of resilience, of survival, and great tragedy. And I think it's important to understand that this world is made of both beauty and tragedy. And in those moments, when we are called to plow through, when we're called to survive, when we are called to do something difficult, we can use those moments of beauty and memory to help us weather the storm. What I found particularly powerful about Jonathan's story is that he went from this moment of deep uncertainty and terror to one of celebration and love. And life is like that. It goes from one to the other with plenty of other special moments in between. And those moments of gorgeousness and beauty, well, those are the ones we should hold on to. Those are the ones that we should use to remind us when life gets challenging. I want to thank Jonathan for sharing his powerful story and for being so vulnerable in this conversation. Thank you to all of you who listen. I'm grateful for you. And I'm grateful for all the ratings and reviews. They really do help other people find the podcast. So if you feel it in your heart to do so, please do consider leaving a rating or writing a little review. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Jonathan. Be resilient. Be steadfast in moving forward when life becomes almost unbearable. Remember the good times, the beautiful times, the times fraught with gorgeousness, and use those times to help yourself become more resilient, become a braver human being, and a human being that knows this universe, this reality, this creation, well, it has your back. It's here for you. Don't ever forget that. It's always, always here for you.